Chapter 25. A Man Called Michael. Humility is my watchword, and I'm one of the humblest broadcasters you'll find. Of course, as a well-known broadcaster, people expect my life to be all lunch with Ranson, dinner and drinks with Dimbleby, lazy barbecues round at the Chegwins, and it's all those things, but I'm also a celebrity who, rightly or wrongly, befriends non-celebrities. In this chapter, I want to talk about one of them, Michael, a friend who is dead. Everyone knows a Michael, but probably not this one. He was an ordinary guy, an average Joe, a normal Peter. Footnote. My phrase. A standard Andrew. Footnote. Also mine. Perhaps those in Norwich might recall local papers prefixing his name with cowardly security guard, or AWOL guard, or suicidal Geordie, or shamed scaredy cat, after he stood down from his post to give a gunman free rein to terrorise North Norfolk Digital in a move that would go on to kill him. But to all intents and purposes, he was a nobody. Let's not dwell on their death, people say when a loved one has died. Let's celebrate their life. Well, with Michael, I'd rather do the opposite, because Michael's life didn't merit all that much celebration. He was an exceptionally low achiever, which I know isn't the be-all and end-all, but it's certainly the be-most and end-most. Let's face it, each of us knows someone like Michael, because there are Michaels all over Britain. Without likening him to a rat, it's fair to say that you're never more than a few feet from a Michael, and another similarity is that given the chance, he will breed like mad. A naturally promiscuous man, Michael once said that the only reason he didn't have a ton of bairns is because he sustained a cock injury in Iraq that rendered him infertile. Oh, but life was tough in the slums of Newcastle, where Michael was born to a tinker and an unskilled seamstress, one of nine children. Footnote. This is all conjecture or guesswork. We never spoke about his family, and I've never been able to find the time to look into it. The young Michael was told to leave school at nine and learn a trade. Footnote. Again, conjecture. He failed to do this, and at 16 he got talking to a couple of officers manning a join-the-army stand at a car exhibition at the NEC. Footnote. Conjecture. The kind who are down with the kids and lure them into conversation by saying things like, "Cool jeans you're wearing. You know what's even cooler? Firing guns." Many moons ago, back in 1969, the 5th Battalion was tough, and a fresh-faced young private would have been thrown in with some pretty rum individuals. This wasn't like the Scouts, where if an undesirable child joined, some of the other parents would get together and, purely to protect the good standing of the troop, go to see the Scout leader mob-handed and say, "If you don't remove that child, we'll be taking our children elsewhere." You simply couldn't do that in the army. In the event, Michael was posted to a few places and probably saw some action. It can be hard to tell for sure because ex-servicemen always insist they saw action, either because of post-traumatic stress disorder warping their memory, or because, as I say, they tend to be low achievers and it makes them feel important to say they fought. Cheeringly, Michael managed to find work as an odd job man at a reputable Linton hotel. Although some people who don't know anything about executive hotels think it's a motel just because you can see it from a dual carriageway and it's called a travel tavern, it actually bore more of the hallmarks of a top London boutique hotel, including 24-hour reception desk, complimentary shoe polisher near the lifts, which were also complimentary, and a savvy, discerning clientele who wanted five-star service for a three-star price. Although managers should avoid looking at TripAdvisor, where a handful of unhappy customers have absolutely gone to town on them. Here, an eager young Michael found work, glad to be back in a role where he was told what to do and got to wear a uniform each morning, albeit a pastel paisley waistcoat and cheap polyester trousers that went vip, vip, vip when he walked fast. And this is where Partridge comes in. I bumped into Michael at the bar one night. He was collecting ashtrays, then trying to use the discarded butts to make a super fag, a composite of other people's cast-offs. He was surprisingly adept at this, and I complimented him on his handiwork, even pretending to agree the super fag was mine if a superior came past and smelt the smoke. I watched as he chugged at it greedily, the paper along its length discoloured by lipstick and other men's spittle. And we started to chat. Me about work. Carol, my cars. Him about wanting to push his thumbs into his drill sergeant's eye sockets until he felt them pop. Eventually, Michael came to regard me as a firm friend, and although his lack of qualifications made it impossible for me to reciprocate, I did become kind of fond of the guy. Late into the night, we'd be at the hotel bar chatting about army/scout life, or sitting in quiet contemplation, or racing around the tables, seeing who could collect the most beer mats before reconvening at the bar to count them up like they did at the end of the Crystal Maze. Life moved on, I moved out, and it was only when a friend of mine won the franchise for a BP garage and wanted help that I spoke to Michael again. He took a job, and I'd see his face on the occasions when I'd pop him for coffee, fuel, or chalk. I'd never go there just to see Michael, I'd tell people. That would be pathetic. No, I only ever go in there for coffee, fuel, and chalk, and then I might stay there chatting for a while. But that's not why I go there. I go there for coffee, fuel, or chalk. But the truth is that I did sometimes go there to see Michael, and would only pretend I needed coffee, fuel, or chalk, because I wanted to talk about, I don't know, what happens if you put a grenade up an exhaust pipe, or how I could go about having Sonia, my then girlfriend, deported. Why couldn't I just have been honest about it? Why couldn't I just tell him how I felt? What's wrong with a guy like me standing close to a guy like him and saying, Michael, I enjoy our chats, and yeah, I want to be with you? Nothing. Well, now it's too late. And that hurts like heckers. After the garage closed and was turned into a US-style car wash, Michael was out of work again. He refused to wash cars for a living because he said he had bad hands. I suspected this was a lie, and my suspicions were confirmed when he came to my house for Christmas dinner, and I watched him shucking sprouts in a colander with lithe, supple fingers and no little speed. It was so impressive, I cut the tip of my thumb while carving the turkey. Second time I've done it. Footnote. Try-hard friends of mine have started to snub turkey in favour of goose or duck, like they're in the 1850s. I'm surprised they don't have a clothes mangle and a pale aunt who coughs blood into a hanky. No, turkey is the best choice for a modern Christmas lunch. While high in sodium, it's rich source of protein, and typically a higher ratio of less fatty white meat to dark meat, around 70-30. The flesh also provides plenty of iron, zinc, potassium, and phosphorus, as well as selenium, which is essential for thyroid hormone metabolism. After lunch, I'll put the dirty crockery back onto the tray and leave it outside the front door for my assistant to collect. Regardless, he needed work, and I was in a position to help, so I agreed to vouch for him when the station, then called North Norfolk Digital, advertised for a security guard. Especially at a radio station, security is a skilled job. Each day the guard has to field visits from pop stars, salesmen, cold callers, angry listeners, and competition winners. The one thing he has to do is protect the security of the front door. As such, some people have argued that Michael failed in his duties. They go on to argue that he is ultimately responsible for the tragedy that led to the death of one person, Michael. Some have even suggested that he's not fit to wear the uniform, even though he bought and paid for it himself. Yes, it's almost as if they're saying that when Michael deserted his post to help himself to wine and mini sausages, unwittingly allowing a deranged gunman to enter the building and take 9 people hostage, he let himself down, he let the station down, and, as painful as it is to say, he let the 5th Battalion down, those still in it, and those who have given their lives fighting for their country. Or that's what some are saying. I'm pleased to say that I'm not one of them, even though I'd vouched for him to get the job and he was kind of throwing it back in my face. No, I'm pretty zen about the whole affair. Umpteen hours passed and a lot of other things happened, and then, for reasons never fully explained, we boarded the roadshow bus, which was gathering dust in the basement, and set off for the coast, Fannell, Michael, and me. Security guard or not, Michael had jumped at the chance to steal, or in his parlance, twock the bus. Twocking is a Newcastlean word for stealing, an acronym for taking without consent. It says something about the Geordie people that taking without consent is such a central part of their lexicon that they've grown tired of having to say it, and in a bid to save time, have rendered it an acronym. The drive took us north to Cromer Pier, where perhaps in an heroic attempt to cause a distraction, or more likely, a less heroic attempt to sidestep the blame he'd shoulder at a subsequent inquest, or simply out of shame for heaping ignominy on the 5th Battalion name, Michael threw himself from the pier into the sea. It was the last time he was seen alive. Later that year, with his remains yet to wash up, Michael was declared dead in absentia by a local coroner. His funeral that week was sparsely attended, but I was only too happy to honour him. Like many funerals, there was a bugler there who was okay, I guess. You don't come to a funeral and start reviewing the musicianship, but there was an unspoken agreement, certainly among the mourners I made eye contact with, that he was quite a weak player. High notes fell strangulated, his pursed lips were over-salivating so that you could hear spit gathering around the mouthpiece, and I thought his rhythm was off. I kept nodding at him at the start of each bar, but he failed to take my cue. He also pulled quite a funny face, which I know a lot of trumpeters do, from Roy Castle to the black chap who sang that song on a Guinness advert once. But this guy's was really stupid. He looked ridiculous. Anyway, he was only about 13, part of the combined cadet force at a local school, so maybe he'll grow out of it. Looking to be helpful, I pushed up the sleeves of my jacket and began bulldozing armloads of earth into the grave, only stopping when I was reminded that Michael had no grave, as he'd never been found, and that the earth nearby had only been dug up to make a rockery. It's been suggested by some that I was unconsciously repeating the actions I'd taken at my father's funeral, and this was classic behaviour of someone who had failed to deal with past emotional trauma, with this new episode bearing all the hallmarks of a man struggling to deal with grief, allowing himself to slip into a behavioural loop in a subconscious quest for closure. I have a lot of time for psychologists, but this transparent mumbo-jumbo does them no favours and sets their profession back 50 years or more. Behavioural loop, I ask you. As I've said, I was merely trying to be helpful, and it was a cheap shirt anyway, so I didn't mind caking it with dirt. Not that I'm sad. Verily, we all grieve in our own way. I like to drive fast round a Tesco car park and or eat Pringles instead of an evening meal. But it's much harder to move on when the dead guy hasn't been found and laid to rest. I sometimes picture his body all bloated and barnacled, his eyes staring, and try to imagine where he is, bobbing around the opening of the marine outfall pipe off the coast of Hull, say, or wedged between a fleet of out-of-season pedalos in the Solent. But on other days I imagine that he survived, and I wonder about his new exciting double life, working as a croupier in a casino in New Orleans, perhaps, or maintaining a fleet of out-of-season pedalos in the Solent. Either he's alive or dead. I just wish I could know for sure which one it is. I long to be able to send him a message, to reach out. You'll notice that the first letters of each paragraph in this chapter spell, "Hello, Michael, are you still alive?" Struggled a bit with the V. I can see, thinking about it, that there's no real benefit to sending him coded messages, as I'm not the one who's living a secret life, but I shan't go back and undo it now. All I'll say is, Michael, if you are out there, send me a sign. Maybe we could meet and talk about armored vehicles. Yes, I should like that very much.